Paper 12, section 6, which is old single column, page 135. All right, so let's see. What do we want to say up front here? I think we'll just let it kind of speak for itself here. Notice kind of what I teased at the end last time. I was reminding you that it obviously wasn't a coincidence that what was leading up to this, you know, in a space that didn't seem that likely, and talking about space and motion and space and time, that the mother-father contrast sort of naturally came out of that discussion. And that's because it's building to coming as close to sort of openly talking about that as they can at this point, way in advance of paper 117, where they actually directly start talking about the mother. But you'll see it continues to build in this section. Whenever you're talking about over control, you know, that has a distinct possibility of being more than existential over control. You know, it could very well be cosmic over control that's being referred to. That is over control that is directly with us in time and space, which of course is the mother. So, I'll just keep teasing that out as we go forward, so as you can see how it's meant to build in a very definitive fashion, moving into the next section about the part and the whole.
6. Universal overcontrol. The universe is non-static. Stability is not the result of inertia, but rather the product of balanced energies, cooperative minds, coordinated maranches, spirit over control, and personality unification. Stability is wholly and always proportional to divinity.
Now, that's an expansion of a very simple statement that they tell you up in the early part of the book, that the universe is mind-made and personality-managed. Okay? It's basically what it's saying. That there's no just simple stasis that keeps it as it should be, quote unquote, nor just someone, the watchmaker God just started it going and it just goes on by inertia. You know, it has so much inertia that it'll just keep on going no matter what. No, it's not something simple like that. It's an insanely complex infinity that requires infinite personalities at the top of it all to personally manage it. There's nothing automatic about the universe. In the same way that when you talk about human civilization, something automatic about civilization. Civilization is a choice. The stability of the cosmos is a choice. It's chosen by the creators to be, and that's why it is. And look at that little sequence there of having energy, mind, morantia, spirit, and personality. Kind of fun that they throw in sort of both of the intermediate facts of mind and morantia, and using co-words as adjectives on both of them, directly with the morantias, they use the mother word, coordinated, You know, like if you look on the chart here, you know, moda is a system of harmony. Okay, so fundamentally, if you're talking about maranchas, you're talking about harmony in a very direct way. It's sort of just, even, you know, when you get your next body, your body has a measure of that harmony, that weaving of individuality and unity, just as part of its construct. So harmony is really up front. And so what word do they use? They use the individuality of the whole. You know, that harmony has been brought into the universal harmony. They're coordinated harmonies, coordinated maranchas. And cooperative minds, minds that are working together, another way you could describe that is kindred minds. And what gets you kindred minds? Not wishful thinking kindred spirits. Kindred spirits is the potential for kindred minds, but the fact of kindred minds results from a choice to consecrate your mind to the universal harmony. Again, you know, the mother. The facts of those two in between are very immediately the result of synchronization with the mother, consecration to the mother. And you know, it all starts by the potential to do that with the gift of personality from the Father, and the unification that it can bring into the system. So, you know, just notice how they're starting us out. They're starting us out with a lot of allusion to the threefold actuality with unity, some obvious tweaking to suggest the mother. So in other words, this whole bit about mind, maiden, personality, managed, I'd like to expand on that a little bit, give you less of just what could become a platitude, you know, relationship to that sentence, and flesh it out, give it a richer organic recognition in your mind. So let's see where they take us.
In the physical control of the Master Universe, the Universal Father exercises priority and primacy through the Isle of Paradise. God is absolute in the spiritual administration of the cosmos in the person of the Eternal Son. Concerning the domains of mind, the Father and the Son function coordinately in the conjoint actor.
Now just notice what they did there. They didn't put the Father up front. I mean, really, you have the absolute of matter, the Isle, the absolute Spirit, the Eternal Son, and the absolute mind, the conjoint actor. So, you know, they even purposely use the conjoint actor designation, the absolute mind. They put the threefold actuality. The Father is just an unseen fact as the universal controller behind the Isle. So that should kind of strike you. That's kind of interesting. They didn't augment that with the personality, some statement about the personality circuit, you know, the volitional absolute or anything like that. They've got the Father really in the background. So let's see where they, you know, why that might be. Yep, you got to.
Going back a paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
They're in this list of things. They end with personality unification.
Mm-hmm.
Are they talking about personalities uniting, or are they talking about an individual personality finding unity?
Yeah, personality unification. Okay, it's the threefold actually with unity. The personality engages the threefold actuality and creates a harmony. You know, that unification is a tri-unification, as it were. Right? That's what we're talking about. Just, you know, that fact that the individuality, associativity, unity is brought together into a harmony by the action of personality.
The third source and center assists in the maintenance of the equilibrium and coordination of the combined physical and spiritual energies and organizations by the absoluteness of his grasp of the cosmic mind and by the exercise of his inherent and universal physical and spiritual gravity complements. Whenever and wherever there occurs a liaison between the material and the spiritual, such a mind phenomenon is an act of the supreme, of the infinite mind, infinite spirit. Mind alone can interassociate the physical forces and energies of the material level with the spiritual powers and beings of the spirit level.
Okay, so first, notice they said conjoint actor, right, at the end of the previous paragraph, and then they start this one up again, and now they say the third source and center. Just that should get you thinking, you know, I wonder if they're going to talk about the part of the third source and center that goes beyond the absolute mind, and that's why they use the more general term than the conjoint actor, the absolute mind. And you start reading, it's like, well, okay, now they seem to be pointing out that you have the physical and the spiritual, the absolute matter and the absolute spirit and the absolute mind, you know, brings those together. But then they say, and universal physical and spiritual gravity complements. Okay, that's what the part of the third source and center that goes beyond the conjoint actor, the absolute mind that we've talked about. That's okay. In the context of this, is the title of this section is universal over control. That's referring to the super controls of the third source and center. The super absolute controls of the third source and center, the stuff that goes beyond the absolute in the third source and center, that ability to override, to whatever extent is needed, the absolute of matter and the absolute spirit. That's the complements of physical and spiritual gravity. And of course, not mentioned here, but there's a third super absolute control. Not only physical gravity and spiritual gravity, but also personality gravity can be overruled to a degree by the third source and center. And of course, that's the mother. That's how the individuality of the whole can connect to absolutely separated persons. There has to be something super absolute to connect to absolutely individuated persons. And that's the complement of personality gravity. So even though they're not specifically mentioned, it because they brought that up back, I guess that was the previous paper, back in the Paradise Trinity paper, you know, that this sentence could remind you of that. It's like, oh yeah, and then there's that personality gravity complement. That's the mother. So in between the lines, it's suggesting that. And notice it's very much kind of a mechanical almost discussion of the threefold actuality, that you have the two substances, they just keep mentioning over and over, spirit on one side, every matter on one side, spirit on the other side, and the coordination in between. So it's obvious that they're wanting you to be thinking about this pattern of the threefold actuality with unity. Sure. Yep.
So when you see the third source and center, and then you automatically can think of the infinite spirit being the third source and center, and then from the infinite spirit comes the creation of the mother spirit.
Well, see, the third source and center is a very generalized term. That is my point of mentioning that. To say third source and center is sort of the most overarching designation. A whole bunch of things kind of fly under that banner. There's the conjoint actor, the third source and center, really just functioning as the absolute mind. There's the infinite spirit. There's the infinite mind, the infinite mother spirit. It is an individuality viewpoint designation, basically, like the first source and center, second source and center, third source and center. But it's a very general term. To use that is, when they do that, you know that they're wanting you to not be focusing on one aspect, but all possible aspects. And in the case of the third source and center, that means a lot of things, because the third source and center is a very diverse fact.
That's the one that goes out to all of us.
The God of action. It's the spear point of everything, yeah. So everything that the Universal Father and the Eternal Son want to do, which is an infinite number of things, goes through the third source and center, goes through the God of action to get to where its destination. Hence the just infinite diversity of the fact of the third source and center. Let's see. So that's basically what you have there. On the surface, like I said, it's just kind of just the two endpoints and the association between them. But there's little things like that personality gravity thing that you could, that are sort of implied by what they're saying, alluded to by what they're saying.
In all your contemplation of universal phenomena, make certain that you take into consideration the interrelation of physical, intellectual, and spiritual energies, and that due allowance is made for the unexpected phenomena attendant upon their unification by personality, and for the unpredictable phenomena resulting from the actions and reactions of experiential deity and the absolutes.
Okay. So there's the statement. Why does this chart always sit next to me? No matter what we're reading, it's here. Because it says in all, not some, it says in all your contemplation of universal phenomena, no matter what you're thinking about, this should be right in front of you. Because what they describe next is the threefold actuality with unity. Okay? Interrelation, a physical, intellectual, and spiritual, and the unification by personality. Matter, mind, spirit, personality. Okay? That's why this chart is here. It's one of the most fundamental things that must always be right in the forefront of your mind. Like we've pointed out, you start at page one of the foreword. They give you a couple paragraphs, just sort of giving you the basic notion of what they're about to do, give you the fifth epical revelation. You go to the third paragraph, and they give you the first definitive little tidbit of revelation. And it is this: things, meanings, values. It's the first thing that's really that you're told on page one. Okay? So here it is again, in all your contemplation. Okay. That's fundamentally why, as I began to methodically, logically, sort of trying to get a handlehold on this revelation and start working my way into it, one of the very first things that I discovered and recognized led to the production of this chart. It's just an inexorable thing. It is just what you must come to first if you're on a logical path of working your consciousness into the revelation.
Maybe it's in part four of the book.
Of course. the Michael Bestowal is a universal phenomenon. one of the everything. You were reading along, and Jesus comments about the golden rule in this strange context of the levels of meaning. And you could go, well, what's the pattern for the, like levels 4, 5, and 6 that I'm not sure exactly what he's talking about. Yeah, 4, 5, and 6. the 3 cosmic intuitions. Because had that once I got to the point of reading that in this new awareness, I knew immediately, when they said moral level and spiritual level, like, I know what that is. I know where that comes from. What's the source of that pattern? You want it right up front so that the very first pattern that you notice is this pattern. There may be a whole bunch of other patterns in play too. But start with this foundational, energy, pattern that grounds your thinking. Before you try to figure out higher things, make sure your thoughts are grounded in the threefold actuality with unity, grounded in the cosmos. And then you're much more likely to be building truthfully from that starting point. Okay, so very direct statement as to why that just always is there by my side. And notice the other thing they say. Besides that, they don't want you to ever lose sight of the fact of experiential deity and the absolutes. Okay, so as an initial reader, what that's really telling you is, don't try to rationalize everything with existential deity. Or more likely, even worse, don't try to rationalize everything with some aggrandizement of a monotheistic God the Father. Yeah, God the Father is very indispensable part of the picture. But don't try to understand everything with just that singular fact. Because if you do try to understand everything with just that, you have to turn that fact into some magical phenomenon that does things that it can't do. It does things that other deity is doing. It does things that the Father delegated to others and can't do. Now, when you just say it like this, obviously it's written for the individuality viewpoint to start with, so that you have the absolutes there. They're saying, okay, you don't try to just rationalize everything with the first, second, third sources and center in the aisle. Don't forget about the 3 absolutes. And then, and then there's that stuff that I don't really understand about, about the supreme and the ultimate experiential deity. Think about it with more sophistication, because we've talked about this a lot. The 3 absolutes together as one fact is the absolute. Personalized as God, the absolute. That's the third experiential deity. The supreme, the ultimate. So you could reword that. Don't forget about the supreme, the ultimate, and the absolute. Don't forget about all of experiential deity. Including the experiential deity that reaches all the way to the point of engaging existential deity, the absolute existential experiential deity. So don't forget about what goes beyond existential deity. See, that's really, when you make that, you bring that all together, it's really what it's saying. Don't forget about all of existential deity, no matter what form it takes. Even if it's so, don't forget about experiential deity. Is that what I think I said existential, didn't I? Don't forget about experiential deity. Even if it takes that very remote expression of the absolute. So removed from us, like we've talked about, that it doesn't really seem to be coming down from above. It's getting at us the other way around and coming up from below. It appears to us, instead of as the absolute, it appears to us as three reservoirs, the absolutes of potential coming up from the bottom. But in the highest sense, follow that back to the top. It's the absolute. It's God, the absolute, experiential deity engaging us. Okay, so the threefold actuality with unity, you don't want to ever forget, and don't forget about the mother. Because what does the supreme, the ultimate, and the absolute have in common? There's a lot of difference between those three facts, but they have one thing in common: the mother. All of them have the mother type deity. They have a bunch of other things too, but that's what they have in common. The overarching facet of deity is the mother, under which you have the supreme, the ultimate, and the absolute. Don't forget about experiential deity, the mother. Okay.
The universe is highly predictable, only in the quantitative or gravity measurement sense. Even the primal physical forces are not responsive to linear gravity. Nor are the higher mind meanings and true spirit values of ultimate universe realities. Qualitatively, the universe is not highly predictable as regards new associations of forces, either physical, mindful, or spiritual, although many such combinations of energies or forces become partially predictable when subjected to critical observation. When matter, mind, and spirit are unified by creature personality, we are unable fully to predict the decisions of such a free will being.
Okay. Bunch of things there. One thing you might just kind of notice that really becomes very apparent by the middle of the paragraph, that they're really talking about that threefold actuality on an equal footing, physical, mindful, or spiritual, you know, association of forces, either physical, mindful, or spiritual. I mean, it's like, wait, I want spirit. I don't want spirit to, you know, thrown in the pot with energy. I want it to be a magical thing. No, it's an energy. Spirit energy, mind energy, material energy. There's three energies. It's a threefold actuality. And those energies come from potentials. There's three reservoirs. Okay? It's just the facts. No magic. And then they tell you, okay, now when you're either of those three, remember it wasn't too long ago we read that section where they were trying to calculate the physical, mental, and spiritual gravity of the whole cosmos. Okay. So all three of them you can engage quantitatively, and you know, there's a degree of predictability to them quantitatively. The behavior of those three energies. When you get into qualitatively, it's not as tangible. They point to an interesting relationship between what we would sort of immediately call quantitative and what you might call qualitative, where they say, even the primal physical forces are not responsive to linear gravity, nor are the higher mind meanings and true spirit values of ultimate universe realities. Pointing out that you push to the real deep fundamental levels of all three energies, and quantity is really meeting quality. And it's not, and because qualitative things in general are not as easy to, you know, put laws down for and to definitively predict, it can start to get a little fuzzy. You can even notice that in case of physical things, if matter is fundamentally the substance that expresses individuality, but you start going all the way to the foundations, you get down to the primordial force, to the force charge of space, and it pervades space. It's not individuated. It's a continuum. It's getting very transcendent of what you would immediately think of as a quantitative fact, an individuated fact that could be measured. It's becoming this unmeasurable continuum a quality, sort of, that underlies the quantity. And even the very first things that come out, that are distilled out of that, automatons, are not subject to linear gravity. Absolute gravity, yes, but not linear gravity. So they're not sort of fully quantitative like mass is. And they're called automatons. And they, in referring to the other two energies, they said, the higher mind meanings and true spirit values of ultimate universe realities. In other words, if you get to impinging upon ultimacy, be it physical energy, mindal energy, or spiritual energy, you're getting more to quality than quantity. So they're treating them very, in very much in parallel, all three energies here.
Yeah. Quantitating. Mm-hmm. So that would mean that that's the whole ball of wax.
No. Quantitative just means the things that you can measure, that you can think of as a quantity. 5 gallons, 12 pounds, 3 feet, quantity. Okay? Something that you can measure, okay? And like I was saying, if you're going to measure it, if you're going to say it's some number in some unit, you're counting somehow. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of these individuations. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 units. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 pounds. Okay? But if you take the four shards of space, a continuum, there's nothing to count. Imagine I could break it up into units and then count the units? I can make the units as small as I want. It's a continuum. There's no holes in it. So there's an infinite number of units. It's not countable. It just doesn't have any immediate way to quantitate it, okay? To measure its quantity. But it has a quality. It has a quality of ubiquity. It's everywhere present. And that's kind of cool. That
you count it as one.
Yeah. You could count it as unity. Oh, and that's that is the fundamental quality of deity. Unity. See? That's what I'm saying. See, it's coming all the way around to the other side. You try to separate things into deity and reality. But you go to the fundamentals of reality and you're impinging upon deity and the unity of deity, and the reality expresses as just oneness, unity. Yeah. That's just the basic. You don't have to dissect totally. That's just the basic what they're trying to get out there. And then reminding you that when you bring in this fourth block here on the chart, personality, and not in some whatever way you want to think of that personality doing something, it can only do one thing. When matter, mind, and spirit are unified by creature personality, all it can do is tri-unify. It can't bi-unify or declare one of them to just be innately unified and be true in what it's doing. It can do that falsely. Of course, we know we have free will. We can imagine that we're using our personality to do something that's not real, not conformal to the cosmos. But true actualization of personality is this tri-unification of the three. And that should be just really mystifying initially. So it's like, I thought I was a person. I'm trying to think of something where I think I've combined the three and I can't come up with anything. Yeah, that's kind of the point, to bring in a little humility. Even the best of us can do very little of this fact at this point. And then on top of it, it's sad to record, okay? That most people aren't even trying to bring harmony. They're trying to absolutely exalt singularity into a complete lifestyle solution or something. They're not trying to somehow humbly let go and find harmony and bring it in. Okay, so and when that happens, if you actually manifest the harmony that comes from that potential of personality, personality is absolutely unique. Every personality is absolutely unique. So there's no way to predict. You know, every time a personality actually does that, anywhere in the universe, high or low, everyone goes, whoa, that's out of the blue. That's different. That's unanticipatable. Yeah, that's what personality is like. Okay. So, you know, it takes quantitative. If it's really definitively quantitative, you can calculate it quite well. Starts getting into quality, and they say, well, you know, in the bigger senses, you can still calculate some. Like they say, you know, it becomes partially predictable. You go all the way from quantity to quality to personality. Okay, and then it loses all predictability because every expression is absolutely unique. So that's the spectrum they're giving you. All right.
All phases of primordial force, nascent spirit, and other non-personal ultimates appear to react in accordance with certain relatively stable but unknown laws and are characterized by a latitude of performance and an elasticity of response, which are often disconcerting when encountered in the phenomena of a circumscribed and isolated situation. What is the explanation of this unpredictable freedom of reaction disclosed by these emerging universe actualities? These unknown, unfathomable unpredictables, whether pertaining to the behavior of a primordial unit of force, the reaction of an unidentified level of mind, or the phenomenon of a vast pre-universe in the making in the domains of outer space, probably disclose the activities of the ultimate and the presence performances of the absolutes, which antedate the function of all universe creatures, creators. We do not really know, but we surmise that such amazing versatility and such profound coordination signify the presence and performance of the absolutes, and that such diversity of response in the face of apparently uniform causation discloses the reaction of the absolutes, not only to the immediate and situational causation, but also to all other related causations throughout the entire master universe.
Okay, so let's just put the big picture of those two paragraphs all together. What they're saying is, okay, you, even if you're a really, really high-level physicist on Uversa, you try to draw a box around some phenomenon and you know, write down every equation, every variable, and figure out exactly what's going on, the universe isn't purely finite, like the box that you just drew. And so, you know, no matter how much you carefully scrutinize the boundaries and the contents, there's no way to know if there might be something in play inside that box that gets the attention of a transcendent fact. What if what's going on in that box is not just finite significant? I mean, even if just a measure of supremacy comes into play, something is going to come in through the walls, over the walls, you know, of the box of your experiment, let alone the ultimate or the absolute. Okay, that's basically what they're pointing out. That, you know, and it can be, like they're saying, you can have, see, circumscribed and isolated situations. Yes, they think they've got this very definitively boxed fact. Nothing can get in, and they can scrutinize exactly, and they can calculate exactly what's going to happen. And then out of the blue, comes the finger of the ultimate and stirs the pot. Yeah. Or even more, like they're saying in the last one. It could even go higher than that. You know, it could be something that goes beyond the whole of the master universe for which this apparently little system is significant. It could be the cosmos infinite. The whole that's in play might go beyond God the ultimate functioning as God the Mother. It might go to God the absolute functioning as God the Mother. And then see, all bets are off because you're taking the cosmos infinite into account in terms of this apparently isolated system. Just give you a simple example to bring it home a little bit. You know, you're reading in the Jesus papers, or you're reading some other place in the book, and a personalized adjuster appears. Okay? See, that means that whatever is going on there absolutely transcends the specifics of what's going on there. There's something in play that involves the cosmos infinite. It involves infinity. It involves the eternal past, the eternal present, and the eternal future simultaneously, and everything that's in that total eternity somehow is in play there. And so, can you predict what's about to happen? No, it's impossible. It involves a knowledge of infinity. And no one has that except the three infinite persons. And there's everything down below that, like they're saying. I mean, you can have things coming into play that just really transcend the immediacy of what's going on. And so that's why they said up there, don't forget that experiential deity is always present. Just God the Supreme functioning as God the Mother, if it's just that whole and the individuality of that whole. See, a fact that takes the whole account as if it was one fact, there's an individuality of that whole. There's the Universal Mother. She takes into account everything that ever will be in the finite when she engages some specific thing in the finite. Just that will trump any of your attempt to predict, let alone if the ultimate or the absolute come into play.
Okay. The challenge is the notion that anything is ever going to be circumscribed or isolated anyway.
Right. Nothing actually absolutely is. It's just the act of science begins with the recognition that what's inside my box, what is not, let's say it this way, what's not inside my box relative to what's inside my box makes what's outside the box negligible. I can neglect what's outside. And you say, well, how do you know that? Well, we could just try. Let's you know, look at everything that's in the box, write down the equations, predict what it's going to do, and watch it. You know, and if our predictions closely match what actually happens, sure enough, we can neglect the stuff that's outside. You know, we can neglect higher mind, for instance, or even really mind at all, you know, if it's us who are the physicists, because we don't know anything about mind energy, we have to assume that everything is in the box is, you know, is purely physical, and we can neglect mind, you know, all finite mind even. You know, me sticking my finger in there and going like that, you know, that's not going to happen. Yeah. Okay, so that basically they're reminding you of what they were saying up above, and you know, when they say primordial force, nascent spirit, remember up above they were pointing to the ultimate, you know, automatons and, you know, other ultimate facts relative to mind and spirit. You know, when you're dealing with something that you're calling ultimate, remember why you called it that, because the ultimate might decide that he needs to do something here. Okay? He has a direct relationship to ultimate things, like automatons. So when they say, see, where did they actually, whether pertaining to the behavior of a primordial unit of force, that's an automaton. You can't always predict everything that an automaton is going to do. Sometimes it does disconcerting things. Whoa, where did that come from? Why did it do that? Yeah. All right.
So, Chris.
Yep.
Automatons are smaller than atoms, right?
They're smaller than any particle. There's smaller. It's an ultimate individuation of physical reality. You know, way beyond anything that any scientist has any notion of.
But it has personality.
No. No, it's just a thing. Yeah. But it's, well, but let me just follow that up. But God the ultimate is a person. And so a person might decide to manage that automaton. Right, right, and if he does, you know, a personality is about to make a decision to manage this cup, okay, and no one could predict that.
Yeah. Individuals have their guardians of destiny, planets, systems, constellations, universes, and super universes. Each have their respective rulers who labor for the good of their domains. Havona and even the grand universe are watched over by those entrusted with such high responsibilities. But who fosters and cares for the fundamental needs of the master universe as a whole, from paradise to the fourth and outermost space level? Existentially, such overcare is probably attributable to the Paradise Trinity. But from an experiential viewpoint, the appearance of the post-Havona universes is dependent on 1, the absolutes in potential, 2, the ultimate in direction, 3, the supreme in evolutionary coordination, 4, the architects of the master universe and administration prior to the appearance of specific rulers.
Okay, let's break some things down a little bit there. So if we went forward in our imagination and had the whole master universe functioning as a populated whole, who would foster and care for the fundamental needs of that whole? Answer that question that they put in there.
The Mother of Paradise Trinity.
No, that's not a person. It's the Mother, but it's God the ultimate functioning as God the Mother. Okay, because the womb is the master universe. Okay. Who's the mother of that great big womb? The whole master universe. It's not God the Supreme is God the Mother. It's a lot bigger than that fact. It's a lot bigger than what we now call the Universal Mother. Okay, it's the whole master universe. It's got the ultimate functioning as God the Mother.
What was the question you asked? Because it says the Paradise Trinity here.
No, right in the middle. But who fosters and cares for the fundamental needs of the master universe as a whole, from paradise to the fourth and outermost space level? Okay.
Existentially, probably attributable to
right, but we're not talking existentially. We're talking experientially.
Experiential deity.
Right. Who's actually intimate with that fact so that there can be fostering and caring? It had not only a need for intimacy, but there's a need for personality. I care for you because I'm a person. Right, so you can answer that question. And that's God the ultimate function. He's God the Mother. And where does all this Mother deity come from? Existentially, from the Paradise Trinity. See, they're basically, kind of giving you all the hints, you know, just go ahead and run with it now that we know what, you know, what's really going on here, now that we've sorted this out. But having said that great big thing, they drop back down to a simpler picture. They drop back down to just the super universes, you know, the post-Avoni universes, in other words, just the, you know, the seven super universes, the super universe level. Okay, forget about the outer space levels. You just have the seven super universes. And when you look at what's going on there, you notice four facts relative to, what's the title of the section? Universal overcontrol. Take number three first. Seven super universes. In other words, the universe of local universes, all within the womb of the grand universe. There's a hole there, the grand universe. All of that, the universe of local universes is within that hole. The individuality of that hole, the universal mother, has something to say about that hole, the grand universe. So, you know, here we're a lot of papers prior to paper 117 where they openly talk about the mother, but the supreme in evolutionary coordination. Coordination, it's a mother word. Okay. The supreme as the mother of the evolutionary whole. Okay. So that when you see this overcare, like they're pointing out, when there's the immediate possibility of what's making the whole finite have this wonderful coordination is the coordinator of the whole finite, the universal mother. So that would be your first suspicion. But maybe it goes beyond that. Maybe it goes beyond what's immediate, you know, the mother of the immediate age, of the present age, the finite age. Well, I mean, from just a viewpoint of the finite age, I mean, that's the universal mother. That's the whole mother. So if we're going to bring in experiential deity beyond that, just from a finite perspective, we're not going to see directly the hand of God, the ultimate, as God the mother. If the ultimate's going to come into play, it's not going to be as a she expression. It's going to be as a he, a transcendent expression, not an immanent expression. So in number two, what do they say? They don't say, you know, here they said the supreme of evolutionary coordination. They didn't say the ultimate of transcendental coordination. See, they didn't say the ultimate as the mother. Not a place-like ubiquitous phenomenon. They said direction even, see? Place and direction. The ultimate as a he. Direction, the ultimate as the ultimate one, that, you know, so if we're here in the finite, if it's going to happen totally transcendent of the finite, even the total finite, it is definitively a he fact. It's a fully God as transcendence fact. It's the ultimate one. It's the ultimate, you know, in direction above. Okay. And, of course, there could be even beyond that for number one, but what did we say? I mean, you go beyond what is really sort of a directly transcendent he-like fact, engaging the finite, the ultimate one. I mean, that's God is transcendence. So, that you know, you can't have two gods of transcendence, really. And the way it works is, like I'm saying, you go all the way to the ultimate. You don't see the absolute one functioning as direction. This phenomenon wraps, you know, God the absolute wraps all the way around. And you experience that within the finite, not as a transcendent direction influence, but as this very subtle welling up from the bottom phenomenon, the absolutes and potential. And like they were saying so much above there, when you really look at the potentials, you notice that they don't just act like static reservoirs. there's a curious coordination phenomenon. It's like, well, you know, at reservoirs don't function. Deity functions. You know, it's not really the reservoirs. It's the absolute. It's God the absolute, okay, that gives that subtle overcare through the absolutes, through this very indirect channel of the reservoirs, of the absolutes. And then, like they're saying, in the early stages, and to a less direct way, ongoing, you have the architects of the master universe too. Those are absonite beings. You know, for instance, the master architect is the absonite one. You know, he's the chief of transcendentalers. So you have the ultimate one, you have the absonite one, and his associates, the rest of the architects, as transcendent facts. You have the so transcendent that it wraps around to the other side fact of the absolute. And then you have the more immediate God as immanence over care, the universal mother.
Is this all about just the creation of massive systems, or does any of this ever trickle down to rivers and mountains and forests?
I believe the answer would be yes, but I can't give you an example. Because what they're basically telling me as they're describing this is beings much higher than me who know details beyond my imagination right now do like they were talking they do in making those gravity surveys. I mean, they look at what's going on with certain phenomena, like a mountain or a river, you know, and they look at every automaton in it, and they write down all the equations, and they predict exactly everything's going to happen. But they notice in the 28th decimal place, their prediction is off. There's some really subtle thing going on in that mountain, and they know it's not magic. There's some very subtle hand of some transcendent fact that's touching that mountain, doing something with that mountain. And they can tell because they know about all the boundary conditions. They know how the system works in a way I can't even imagine. They know it's completely inscrutable. There's no boundary condition or anything that would suggest that something needs to be done to this mountain except what they've calculated. And yet obviously something is being done to this mountain. The 28th decimal place is not what it should be. So they're going, well, apparently some higher whole and the individuality of that whole is taking into account that everything else in relationship to this mountain in a completely transcendent way. That's all they're saying. And probably what you find is that they notice that there's kind of a hierarchy of things they can't calculate, like a real definitive thing, and they go, oh, that's probably the universal mother. And then a subtler thing, oh, that's probably the ultimate one. And a really, really subtle thing, well, that's probably the absolute, you know. And I'm sure that's how they've begun to sort of see that what they've been taught about these transcendent facts is true. They've discovered that you can discern there's this influence. Remember what they did. They were literally totaling up the whole finite. You know, and so they really know things to a lot of decimal places. They can really look for very subtle influences. And see, what that has to do with your day-to-day life, who knows?
It's not zero.
But it's not zero. It's indispensable somehow to your eternity, that subtle little thing that the ultimate one is doing to that mountain. You know, and probably to your automatons too. There's very mysterious things that these transcendent facts are involved in, like the connection between your DNA and your personality. There's nothing up front about that connection. It's completely backdoor, completely transcended, completely inscrutable. But they know it's not random. They know there's some subtle hand in play in terms of what combinations of DNA come into existence, you know, and how that relates to all the personalities that ever will be that already exist. Remember, the Father created all personalities that will ever exist before time began. He functions outside of time. All personalities were individuated before time began. And there's this mysterious phenomenon out of that infinite set of personalities. A particular one of those individuations identifies here and now. No one has the slightest idea why. You know, in any direct way. But they know who's involved in some inscrutable way. It's these transcendent facts.
Trust it.
For the mother to be created, basically, she's created mostly from the eternal son.
Not really.
Why do they say the eternal mother son? Isn't that where it comes from?
No. Why do they say the infinite mother spirit?
They don't say that in the beginning.
Well,
I mean,
remember, where it all comes from is transcendent to the Eternal Mother Son. It's transcendent to the Infinite Mother Spirit. You know, it all comes from the Infinite Upholder in association with the Paradise Trinity. That's where it all comes from. That association gives rise to the Mother Deity in the Eternal Mother Son that's added to the Son-type Deity.
Okay, that's what I'm talking about.
See, I mean, the Eternal Mother Son is a consequence of a higher fact. The Infinite Mother Spirit is a consequence of a higher fact. The Creative Mother Spirit, I mean, all the Mother Deity, high and low, is a consequence of something that's higher than any of those things. It's higher than the highest high. It's obviously also higher than the lowest low. It's that infinite upholder in combination with the Paradise Trinity. That's the, you know, the existential fact of the Paradise Trinity, you know, and we know we can fill in the other half of the story in combination with not some reservoir in any direct sense of experiential deity, but self-experiential deity, the lastly of the Father, the infinite upholder, unleashing that self-contained experience. Which is all the Father has, self-experiential, self, unleashing that. The Paradise Trinity can do that. Okay. So, again, you know, you don't want to just try to notice that even way up here in this early paper, they're actually bringing a lot of details that are in no way sort of immediately understandable until you've unpacked a whole bunch of stuff. Okay, I mean, you're just going to read this and it's like, well, okay, but to really understand exactly why it's all there, you got to have a really big picture in play. You have to have sorted out all this stuff. Okay, let's read that last paragraph.
The unqualified absolute pervades all space. We are not altogether clear as to the exact status of the deity and universal absolutes, but we know the latter functions wherever the deity and unqualified absolutes function. The deity absolute may be universally present, but hardly space present. The ultimate is, or sometime will be, space present to the outer margins of the fourth space level. We doubt that the ultimate will ever have a space presence beyond the periphery of the master universe. But within this limit, the ultimate is progressively integrating the creative organization of the potentials of the three absolutes.
Okay, that last part is just a description of God, the ultimate functioning of God the Mother. Present to the outer margins, ubiquitous in that whole womb of the master universe. That's God the ultimate, is God the Mother. You know, and in that those future ages, it'll be doing just what God the Mother is doing now, the focalizer of the summation of now the finite, then it'll be the summation of the absentite. That progressively integrating the creative organization, you know, that's been actualized out of the potentials of the three reservoirs. Okay.
That eminence part begins at the culmination of supremacy, it sounds like. The eminence of
ultimate. Right. I mean, as soon as everyone is an absentite being, you need a, you know, in that sort of temporal way of thinking, you need a mother, you know, in which all those beings are enwombed. The supreme being needs to be in the womb of a higher mother at that point. And so do we.
Interesting how that which served as a womb for all of that age gets to enjoy being in a womb.
Yeah. Condenses down to a point. Now it's just a little baby in the womb. Yeah. Cool. See, behold, all things have become new. See, I mean, literally, the supreme being is born again as the supreme being. See. And that upper part, just a little technical. Point out the little technical thing they're laying out. There's, when you're talking about the three reservoirs and the presence of those reservoirs, the unqualified absolute, the deity absolute, the universal absolute, reservoirs, the potential for, see the order I set them, for matter, spirit, and mind. They talk about, to the same order, they talk about space potency, spirit potency, and mind potency. So they use that potency word for that presence of those three. But notice, it's not matter potency, mind potency, spirit potency. It's mind potency and spirit potency, but it's space potency for the unqualified absolute. See, that's what they're pointing out here. But hardly space present. The potency, the presence of the unqualified, it pervades space. Remember, and space is a literal thing, not the lack of something. Okay, so it's only that presence that's in that stuff that is space. The other two presences are transcendent of space, but they're still presences. Between the lines of what they're saying there. And all of that is important because that's hinting to God the Absolute as God the Mother. Just like they kind of gave detail of God the Ultimate as God the Mother. See, that's hinting to what goes beyond. The presence of God the Absolute as God the Mother.
On page 79, in the same sense that God is the Universal Father, the Son is the Universal Mother.
Existentially. Yeah, it says right there. And what's the sense in which the universal Father is the Father? Existentially. Okay. I've pointed this out a million times. I mean, the word universal mother is used twice in the book. Once there, and once up in the Supreme Papers. Paper 117. Right in the center, experientially, God the Supreme is the Universal Mother, not God the Son. God the Son is existentially the Universal Mother, not experientially. In no way do you experience the Eternal Mother Son, the motherness of the Eternal Mother Son. You do not experience that. That's an existential fact. But you directly experience the universal motherness of God the Supreme. God the Supreme is God the Mother. They never call the Eternal Mother Son God the Mother. They never call the Infinite Mother Spirit God the Mother. But they call God the Supreme God the Mother.
Yeah. The Eternal Mother Son as having been called that because it took the Father and the Son, that those two are the parents of the infinite spirit.
Right. I mean, the basics of what, right there, I mean, you have two parents for a creator son, mm-hmm. a mom and a dad. Okay. So in that simple parent analogy, you can think of, them like that. But there is it goes beyond that. What we're up against is following what they said. They told us, do not try to rationalize everything with experiential deity. Do not try to rationalize everything that you want. Existential deity. Did I say it again, wrong again? Don't try to rationalize everything with existential deity. If you think you've got a mother fact, don't try to rationalize it with the existential eternal mother-son. They just told us not to do that. Don't forget about experiential deity, they just said. It's like, well, I haven't figured out experiential deity. And then, so that's why I'm not using that to understand things. It's like, well, they're telling you gotta figure it out. Okay, let's keep going here. So the part and the whole. All right. The father and the mother, the part and the whole.
There is operative throughout all time and space and with regard to all reality of whatever nature an inexorable and impersonal law, which is equivalent to the function of a cosmic providence. Mercy characterizes God's attitude of love for the individual. Impartiality motivates God's attitude toward the total. The will of God does not necessarily prevail in the part, the heart of any one personality, but his will does actually rule the whole, the universe of universes.
Okay. What they're about to do is they're about to give you the fullness of the Father and what the Father does, so that it's clear what you should be rationalizing with the Father, and hence, consequently, what you shouldn't be rationalizing with the Father. Okay. Okay. They start out with a cosmic providence, lowercase p. When we did the Supreme Papers, we talked about this a bit. There's a whole section up there about providence, for instance. Lowercase p providence. What that is truthfully now understood to be the consequence of. What humans have always called providence. If it's actually providence, that's the Almighty. Okay, equivalent to the function of a cosmic providence, the facet of deity that's functioning. What you call lowercase p providence is the Almighty. The Almighty is just the summation. What really brings an individuality into that whole? Behind lowercase p providence is capital P providence, the mother. Behind the Almighty, the power pattern is the mother, the personal, purposive. Because there's an individuality of the whole, through the Almighty, the mother's relationship to the Almighty, because it's all the Supreme, the Almighty is engaging all things, and there's this mysterious coordination that manifests in the whole, providence. Okay, so they start with that, and then they immediately start talking about the Father. But notice how they say this. He gives you this personality, that gives you this free will, and you can overrule that. So it doesn't always prevail in the part, but his will does rule the whole. It's like, well, why? He pulled himself out of the whole. Why would his will rule the whole? I mean, isn't it just a big empty container with some parts in it? And they don't, and he doesn't rule any of the parts? He just said? So why would he rule the sum of all the parts? Because it's not just an empty container with parts rattling around in it. There's a whole. And is there any disconnect between the father and the mother? No, not one iota. Okay, his will does prevail. You see his will manifest as his way. You see the father manifest as the mother in the universe of universes. Yeah.
In all his dealings with all his beings, it is true that the laws of God are not inherently arbitrary. To you, with your limited vision and finite viewpoint, the acts of God must often appear to be dictatorial and arbitrary. The laws of God are merely the habits of God, his way of repeatedly doing things, and he ever does all things well. You observe that God does the same thing in the same way, repeatedly, simply because that is the best way to do that particular thing in a given circumstance. And the best way is the right way, and therefore does infinite wisdom always order it done in that precise and perfect manner. You should also remember that nature is not the exclusive act of deity. Other influences are present in those phenomena which man calls nature.
The last sentence there, you know, they're just, you know, making sure that you don't start, you know, they mentioned providence and everything. Don't start turning, you know, hurricanes into the acts of God. Okay. Assuming we, you know, we're mature enough now that we can set that aside. Let's talk about the meat of what's going on here. Notice what they're doing there. Simply because that is the best way to do that particular thing in a given circumstance. So, sees all the parts perfectly, knows exactly the path of least resistance, sort of the best way to bring all those parts together into some system. Then he say, and the best way is the right way. It's like, whoa, okay, now that's taking it up a notch. Humans have had a lot of problems with that. You know, absolutizing things like that. Not only is this the best way, it's a right way, and if you think, you know, any other way, you're wrong. And okay, so that's a really charged statement. Okay, but he, you know, perfectly, infinitely faces facts and adjusts them to ideals, has achieved infinite wisdom. See, notice how they say that? And the best way is the right way, and therefore does infinite wisdom always order it done in that precise and perfect way. Precise, best way, perfect, right way. The two are the same thing because there's a wisdom that encompasses both the individuality and the unity. You take the individuality, you take the unity, and the super additive consequence that encompasses. You take true science and true religion, and super added to that is true philosophy. Philosophy, love of wisdom. Okay, there's a wisdom that encompasses that. It's transcendent of true science and true religion. God is the infinite philosopher, as it were. Eh? He faces facts and adjusts his ideals. So that which is best is that which is right. It's perfectly. It's a harmony. See, it's a system of harmony. Okay. So there. That's what the Father does. And keep going. What they say next?
It is repugnant.
Oh, yeah, you got something? Yeah.
Before you go on, maybe this is too simple a question, but do you have a good answer for all these many people who think that they can somehow hold God responsible, or they wonder how God allows, you know, mm-hmm. this act of nature or that to take place?
It has a lot to do with kind of what that universal over control stuff we were just talking about. they're confused because they think that the whole universe is that little box that they're looking at, and it's confusing. It's like, this doesn't make any sense. Why would God allow this chaos? Well, step back. The chaos melts away in the big picture. But there is still this little thing. It's not like that isn't actually there. Yes, but that doesn't exist in isolation of the big picture. There's things in the whole that require that measure of liberty in the part. There's no way to get the whole into existence if you try to micromanage all the parts. You have to give liberty to the parts. Remember how they're pointing out that sometimes there's startling flexibility in a circumscribed place. It's like, wow, is it really okay to allow it that much liberty? That could go really wrong, giving it that much liberty. Yeah, think the smallest part in the whole picture, me, tiny little dot of a finite being, he gave absolute free will to. Is that really smart to give absolute liberty to me? It's like, well, but he didn't give it to me universally. You know, I only have absolute liberty, you know, in terms of my choice of eternity. But when I try to absolutize things, I can cause a lot of havoc. And so why would he allow that? Why would he give me the liberty to hurt others? Or why would he give the earth system the liberty to make tornadoes and kill people? Why would he give it that liberty? Again, the reason is inscrutable, really, I mean, directly. But I know that the only reason that would be is because it's indispensable to bringing the whole into existence. There's no way it can come together. If I absolutely lock down all the parts, there's no way it could come together in a harmony. It has to have the liberty to be brought together into unification. That's fundamentally why bad things happen to good people. So there's no way to really get, I mean, a person has to have the ability to sort of recognize a higher philosophical fact like that, and to not know that, and to know that it's not just a wishful thinking. To know that must be, because you know the universe is inherently logical. Trust God. In terms of a person, it comes down to, you know, the person needs to grow their faith into trust. I mean, faith still is afraid of the unexplained. But trust is not. Trust fears not. From a position of trust, I can know what I just said. That it's needed for the good of the whole, that there is that liberty in the small.
I think people have a lot of problem with trying to fathom how God could allow the Holocaust to happen. And it would be really hard for them to get beyond that.
Yeah, which of course is... the fact that everyone always brings up that example shows you the circumscribed nature of most people's thinking. Okay, 6 million people were killed there. What about the 60 million that Stalin killed? That's just ignored. just that shows you the inability to be really looking at the big picture of things. But as you start to expand the picture out, the problem doesn't get easier. It initially gets harder. If I expand my viewpoints, I see more than just 6 million that died. It gets worse more and more. And I'll expand it over time. How many people have died you know, over all of the last million years. Okay.
It is repugnant to the divine nature to suffer any sort of deterioration or ever to permit the execution of any purely personal act in an inferior way. It should be made clear, however, that if, in the divinity of any situation, in the extremity of any circumstance, in any case where the course of supreme wisdom might indicate the demand for different conduct, if the demands of perfection might for any reason dictate another method of reaction, a better one, then and there would an all-wise God function in that better and more suitable way. That would be the expression of a higher law, not the reversal of a lower law.
Notice how they're taking the more technical stuff that we read in the previous section, kind of putting it into practice here. Yeah, I mean, it could be ultimate or absolute things that come into play. It's not a, you know, it's just higher law. One of the big key things is there at the beginning there for us. If you see yourself as consecrating your will to the perfect will of God the Father, notice that adjective, perfect will. Is it repugnant to you to suffer any sort of deterioration or ever to permit the execution of any purely personal act in an inferior way? Are you trying to be godlike? Do you do things, it's close enough for government work. It's close enough for government work. Do you think like that?
You never heard that expression?
I don't even, never heard it.
Do you try to do, forget about the analogy, do you try to do all things well? Or do you just do them good enough to get by?
Half-assed.
Do you try to do all things well? Not perfect, well. Do you try to do all, do you try to be true to the cosmos? And this is not easy, because initially you try to do it with your spiritual consciousness and you try to do everything perfect, and that's just a catastrophe. Okay? First thing that happens is you get nothing done ever. Okay? Okay? But you can do all things well, and you can get things done, and that requires wisdom that you don't possess initially. You have to have taken delight in cultivating, consecrating your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother, bringing in some wisdom that's in a measure related to that infinite wisdom that we were just reading about. Okay, so that's a really key thing. I mean, get to the point where it's repugnant to you to not try to do it well. The simplest thing, every sentence you write, taking out the garbage, every single thing, try to do it well.
The best of your ability.
Okay? And also just be really careful about the word best. Because your spiritual consciousness can always imagine it better.
Right.
If you try to do it the absolutely best, you'll never do it. Okay? You must have cosmic consciousness to do things well. You have to be able to weigh it, put it in the appropriate relative context. You're not taking any quality out of it, because there's only a certain measure of quality that can be brought into this quantity. You bring the right measure of quality into relationship with that quality, that quantity, and you will have done it well. If you try to bring 600 million gallons of quality into a thimble full of quantity, I mean, not only will you not do it well, you'll never do it, because it's impossible. You'll spend the rest of your life trying to set up, so, you know, to be able to actualize that much quality into the situation.
Make it that perfect.
Spiritually, people who over-favor their spiritual consciousness grind to a halt. They never achieve anything. Because they can't bring the infinite quality that they can envision into some little blob of quantity. One must do something as well as be something. But see, you can't actually do things, let alone do it well, with your, just your spiritual consciousness. You need cosmic consciousness.
And those people, while they can't get do anything, they expect everyone else to do things perfectly.
And they have a huge, long, error and evil detected list that their spiritual consciousness has created for everyone. Okay.
God is not a habit-bound slave to the chronicity of the repetition of his own voluntary acts. There is no conflict among the laws of the infinite. They are all perfections of the infallible nature. They are all the unquestioned acts expressive of faultless decisions. Law is the unchanging reaction of an infinite, perfect, and divine mind. The acts of God are all volitional, notwithstanding this apparent sameness. In God, there is no variableness, neither shadow of changing. But all this, which can be truly said of the Universal Father, cannot be said with equal certainty of all his subordinate intelligences or of his evolutionary creatures.
Okay, now that quote from James, James's epistle in the New Testament, it's really delightful what the Revelator's done here, giving you a really great English expression of that. If you look in various versions of the Bible, I mean, translators have been fumbling over that line forever, and none of them have achieved the true expression like the Revelators. So the Revelators have just given it to us. It's like, really, people? Holy cow. Okay. It's only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 words. Okay? Okay, and why did they put this right, as it were? It's because it's a great expression to understand the existentialness of the Father. Okay? In God the Father, there is no variableness. So directly, there's no direct variation. Father doesn't directly have any variation. And not only that, neither shadow of changing. Something else out here changes. Casts a shadow on the Father. It's like, well, does the Father change because of that? No. Neither direct variation or indirect variation. The Father changes not. Okay? That's the point of those two sides, direct and indirect. No shadow cast upon the Father produces a change in the Father. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Father's absolutely, totally changeless. Purely existential deity. And once that really sinks in, it should become pretty apparent why you need experiential deity. How on earth are you going to rule a changing cosmos with nothing but a totally changeless fact? Where not even the shadows cast by the changes out here change him. He can't do it all himself. There has to be experiential deity, changing deity. Not only indirectly changing, but directly changing deity, experiential deity.
But the changeless is a great start and a great foundation.
It's an anchor point for all the change.
Right, right.
Not only is it, you know, is it a sort of a reference point for the change, but it's, how could something change if there wasn't something changeless? How would you know it changed?
Just like the paradox.
Right, everything. Right, there has to be an absolute, right? Yeah.
It has to be an existential behind just an experiential.
Right. Or experiential is illogical. So that's one of the really key things in there. Just really drive that home by giving us that nice expression of that passage from James.
Because God is changeless, therefore can you depend in all ordinary circumstances on his doing the same thing in the same identical and ordinary way. God is the assurance of stability for all created things and beings. He is God, therefore he changes not.
But remember, there's always the extraordinary. Personalized adjusters do appear. Not everything is ordinary.
Yeah.
Okay, but, okay.
And all this steadfastness of conduct and uniformity of action is personal, conscious, and highly volitional. For the great God is not a helpless slave to his own perfection and infinity. God is not a self-acting automatic force. He is not a slavish, law-bound power. God is neither a mathematical equation nor a chemical formula. He is a free will and primal personality. He is the universal Father, a being surcharged with personality, and the universal fount of all creature personality.
The universal fount of all creature personality, what's the proper term for that facet of the Father?
Universal.
No. Reservoir. Fount. The word fount literally means, starts with an S. Source.
Source.
The first source. Okay. He's the first source, the universal fount of all creature personality.
Okay, and we have personality that can be happy or sad. Can God be happy or sad?
We're made in the image of God. Is there just one facet of God? Is God the Son, God the Spirit, God the Supreme, God the Ultimate, God the Absolute, God the Sevenfold, God the Mother? There's a lot of facets to God. You're made in the image of all God, not just God the Father. You're made in the image of God. Some of God is experiential deity.
Which means happy and sad.
Yeah. All right. You can change. If there wasn't experiential deity, you couldn't exist. As you know yourself. If all there was this changeless God the Father, my existence is utterly illogical. Where would I have come from if all there is God the Father? I change, he's changeless. Well, there must be just some magic that, you know. No, there's no magic. If I can change, there must be a source of change. There must be a God of change. It's not the Father. That's the key, see? It's just a logical recognition.
The will of God does not uniformly prevail in the heart of the God-seeking mortal, material mortal. But if the time frame is enlarged beyond the moment to embrace the whole of the first life, then does God's will become increasingly discernible in the spirit fruits which are born in the lives of the spirit-led children of God. And then, if human life is further enlarged to include the Maruntia experience, the divine will is observed to shine brighter and brighter in the spiritualizing acts of those creatures of time who have begun to taste the divine delights of experiencing the relationship of the personality of man with the personality of the universal Father.
See how they're invoking the same thing I did, Joan, of pulling back and seeing a bigger picture in order to understand things better? You know, whether or not it's a bigger stretch of time or just a bigger region of space, either way, you know, it can become more understandable if you'll take a bigger point of view. It's just bound to be inscrutable and disappointing, really. You know, if you walk around with this, you know, pipe that you're looking through, trying to understand reality.
The fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man present the paradox of the part and the whole on the level of personality. God loves each individual as an individual child in the heavenly family. Yet God thus loves every individual. He is no respecter of persons, and the universality of his love brings into being a relationship of the whole, the universal brotherhood.
Here's another way to understand how the Father is the initiator, you know, of everything. How the Father is the initiator of the Mother. Okay. God loves each individual. Now, we've pointed this out many times. The Father only relates to an individual. Now, of course, he relates to an infinite number of individuals, but only as individuals. So each and every, yes, like they're italicizing there, but, you know, every is not all. Every is ever each. You know, okay? God does not relate to, the Father does not relate to all. He relates to each and every, not all. Okay? The Father, this is, it's another limitation of the fact of the Father. Okay, but look what they say. It's like, well, because he relates to every each, there's a potential there. There's a potential for a whole. Okay? He out of the potential of that potential of the Father comes a being. Comes into being a relationship of the whole. The individuality of the whole. Okay? The Father only has the potential for the mother. Father's not the mother. And this is another way of thinking about how he comes right up to the point of having a relationship to all, but can't get past every. See? That's as close as he can get. He's the potential for harmony, but he's not the actuality of harmony. The mother is the actuality of the harmony. See, it doesn't say, then he transforms into a being. No.
Love.
Okay. See, it's just putting the technical stuff about the Father and Mother in more personal, you know, using the word love and the analogy of the love relationship to see this potentializing of the initiator giving rise to the mother. Okay.
The love of the Father absolutely individualizes each personality as a unique child of the Universal Father, a child without duplicate in infinity, a will creature irreplaceable in all eternity. The Father's love glorifies each child of God, illuminating each member of the celestial family, sharply silhouetting the unique nature of each personal being against the impersonal levels that lie outside the fraternal circuit of the Father of all. The love of God strikingly portrays the transcendent value of each will creature, unmistakably reveals the high value which the Universal Father has placed upon each and every one of his children, from the highest creator personality of paradise status to the lowest personality of will dignity among the savage tribes of men in the dawn of the human species on some evolutionary world of time and space.
Okay, now see again. Notice how they're talking. There's a lot of poetry, a lot of, you know, attempt to really get you into the game here as a person. But think about this very technically. You know, this I point this out all the time. The love of the Father, I was like, oh, I love the love of the Father. But look what it absolutely individualizes each personality. The love of the Father makes you absolutely disconnected from every other individual.
It makes you feel special.
He doesn't love you relatively so that you can still stay connected. He loves you absolutely, which absolutely individuates you, disconnects you from every other individual. His personality he gave you is absolutely unique. Doesn't overlap with another personality. Absolutely disjoint, separate. And they've tried to put that in as stark as term possible. So you've got this circle that's you, when the Father is engaging you with his absolute love and you're basking in this. And then they say, did you notice what's around you? Each personal being against the impersonal levels that lie outside that circle. Here's you, absolutely loved and hence absolutely individuated. And around you is no personality. Around you is an impersonal background. you're absolutely cut off.
Pixelated.
I mean, like I say, I mean, if you really let this sink in, to see yourself against an absolutely imperfect background like that, you should feel a real emptiness. It's like, wait a minute, that's not what I experienced. I don't think that's true. Yeah, what's missing? If all there was is the Father, that's what you would experience. You would experience nothing but the Father. You wouldn't experience me talking. You wouldn't experience the chair you're sitting on. How do you experience anything but the Father? There has to be something besides the Father.
Something experiential.
Something that is... that overlays that impersonal background and fills all the gaps between the little circles. Actually, it goes through all the circles too. Okay, something that pervades it all.
I just had the thought, is that what Lucifer is experiencing on the Father's world right now? He's disconnected himself from the Mother, basically, more and more. And so he's just, the Father is the only thread he's basically...
Well, except he doesn't even have that anymore, remember? You know, he's iniquitous, so he's severed his tie to the Father. Now he's just a bubble unto himself.
No personality control.
Right, there's no personality connection at all.
Well, you know, the way you look at this, it's really cool. When you think about it, okay, so he loves each of us individually. And then through this love, if we can... give it to other people, or at least be able to realize that because he's in us, he's in everybody else.
Right, what we're trying to get to is the rest of the story that you're describing. But how can you do that? You know, so you feel this absolute love of the Father, but you're not in contact with any other person. How? I desperately want to share this love. How do I do that? This distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other. Okay, you know what they're building up to. Okay, so, you know, and notice there's this whole fatherhood of God, and they keep bringing up the brotherhood of man as the other side of the story. Okay?
There must be a way.
There must be a way for the brotherhood of man. Yes.
This very love of God for the individual brings into being the divine family of all individuals, the universal brotherhood of the free will children of the Paradise Father. And this brotherhood, being universal, is a relationship of the whole. Brotherhood, when universal, discloses not the each relationship, but the all relationship. Brotherhood is a reality of the total, and therefore discloses qualities of the whole and contradistinction to qualities of the part.
Okay. I mean, everyone here who's been listening to me for any length of time knows what they just said to you there. See?
All are.
Okay. All right, the all are. See, it's right there. Just they're italicizing the words. So they're trying to get you to see it. And this brotherhood, being universal, is a relationship of the whole. Well, the Father is not the whole or the individuality of the whole. He's the individuality of the parts. He makes you a part and a potential in the all. Okay? But only potential. He only gives you personality. Not the actuality of harmony. You have to, that's a separate thing. The brotherhood of man does not come by consecrating your will to the perfect will of God the Father. You have to consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. You have to consecrate your mind to be a fact that can be linked across this impersonal gap between you and every other person. This impersonal background, something that is greater than the absoluteness of the Father's individuation of you, as the individuality of you as a part. Something super, some super absolute control. Like we were talking about them. Something that can overrule that. Okay, and see, reality, brotherhood is a reality of the total. Totality attitudes. Where does that come from? Not from the Father, from the Paradise Trinity, the source of the Mother. And therefore discloses qualities of the whole. And notice they didn't say in distinction to the qualities of the part. Contradistinction, so that you don't misunderstand. Opposite distinction. There's a line, they're saying, and there's something on one side of the line and something on the other side of the line. There's something without and something within. There's God as transcendence, and there's God as immanence. The individuality of the parts and the individuality of the whole are contra-distinct. Not just distinct, contra-distinct. One is God as transcendence, one is God as immanence. One is in, one is out. There's a boundary. That's what contra means. Now, it means that that you draw a line and you take two things and you face them to each other on the two sides of the lines. They face each other across that line. That's what contra means. That's what opposite means. They're not at war against each other, okay? But they're on opposite sides of a boundary. One fact freed itself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. One fact pulled itself outside of the whole. The other fact remained in God's immanence, the Mother. And when you didn't have that line, there wasn't Father or Mother. Because the word immanence and transcendence doesn't mean anything without the line. Those words don't exist yet.
And you have a concept.
But as soon as you draw the boundary, okay, then Father and Mother come into existence. Father on one side, Mother on the other side. They're in contradistinction. One is the individuality of the parts, the other is the individuality of the whole. And it's more than that. There's a deity that is the individuality of the parts. And there's a deity flavor that's the individuality of the whole. The type of deity that's the individuality of the whole is the Mother type deity. The type of deity that's the individuality of the parts is Father type deity. If you personalize the Father type deity, you have God the Father. If you personalize the Mother type deity, you have God the Mother. Who's called God the Mother? God the Supreme, functioning in a personal, purposive way. It's God the Mother.
In another part of the book, it says, when we recognize that God is our Father, we reason that all men are our brothers. So reasoning brings into play the mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the spirit, that spirit laser.
Right. The brotherhood of man is not the association of kindred spirits. It's the system of kindred minds. That's the brotherhood of man. We haven't achieved the brotherhood of man in spite of 2,000 years of in the wake of the spiritual uplifter and the factualization of kindred spiritness. Universal bestowal of thought adjusters. It's not anything fuzzy anymore. I mean, we are very definitively kindred spirits now. Every one of us has a thought adjuster. We still don't have the brotherhood of man. Why? It's not for lack of wishing. People have been wishing with all their might for 2,000 years, and it hasn't happened. It's because it's sad to record. That there is almost no one who's taking delight in cultivating, having a relationship with the God of immanence, the actual fact that connects two persons together in the cosmic system. Yep.
A vital distinction.
Yep, this distinction is vital.
I think on our planet at this time, there's like two competing ways of thinking. One says we need to keep Christianity at the cutting edge with the fatherhood of God and somehow grow into that. I don't know.
Right, but what do you actually need to do? Do you need to go all the way, you know, to be only on one side of the line? You know, that side, the father side, or all on the mother side? No, you need both. You need an and, not an or. You need to consecrate your will to the perfect will of God the Father and consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. Not or. Not Western and Eastern, you know, or Eastern, or, you know, both. Okay. All right, yeah, no dichotomy. Contradistinction, yes, but not a dichotomy.
Brotherhood constitutes a fact of relationship between every personality in universal existence. No person can escape the benefits or the penalties that may come as a result of a relationship to other persons. The part profits or suffers in measure with the whole. The good effect and the good effort of each man benefits all men. The error or evil of each man augments the tribulation of all men. As moves the part, so moves the whole. As the progress of the whole, so the progress of the part. The relative velocities of part and whole determine whether the part is retarded by the inertia of the whole or is carried forward by the momentum of the cosmic brotherhood.
Carried forward by the momentum of the cosmic brotherhood. We progress in spite of ourselves. You know, like we so often say. And of course, on the negative side, thinking about what they're saying. So this all starts out, brotherhood constitutes a fact of relationship between every personality in universal existence. This distinction is vital. Okay, members of a cosmic are not related, fact of relationships, they're not related to each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. See, brotherhood is a fact of the mother, not the father. And so think about what that means. Like they're just saying, think about the double-edged sword that they just pointed out. Because we are connected one to another through her, and she doesn't relate to us in each fashion. She relates to us in all fashion. Okay? That's the kind of not respecter of persons she is. It's an all-like way, not an every-like way. What does that imply? It implies things like there's no way that you can have a person choose iniquity and have it not have a universal consequence. She doesn't, it's not just going to touch some, it's going to touch all. That's the way she works. And so understand that because that's what she is, that she's the all fact, then you can understand why the creative Mother Spirit directed her angels to work for unlimited opportunity for sin expression, as it says on page 618 up in the Lucifer Rebellion. You know, our spiritual consciousness, you know, it's like, why does there have to be sin expression? Well, it's because there's an all. She literally has, the angels are working day and night to get unlimited opportunity for sin expression in play. You need to get this negative fact in the all. And only then can it be out of the all. I mean, this is the universe we live in. We live in a universe, this distinction is vital. It's the life we live.
You said sin opportunity. You didn't say they're out there sinning.
Expression.
Right. I mean, directed to work for full disclosure of the rebellion and unlimited opportunity for sin expression. Yeah.
Right. So the opportunity is there. It's like, hey, guys, yeah. Here it is. Yeah. But they're not out there sinning.
A lot are. Because it's, you know. I mean, again, you know, don't, I mean, it's not like the whole planet has to go to iniquity. I'm not saying that.
Right.
It's the opportunity. You have to get the opportunity fully in play. Yeah. Because then and only then can there be a holistic choice, a wholehearted choice by the whole cosmic system to reject it. The cosmic system has to reject it.
Right. You want it to be gone, it has to be all gone.
Yep. Has to be all gone, not each or every gone, all gone. Yeah. It just you know, really puts a whole different light on a lot of this. Okay. Keep going here before it gets too late.
It is a mystery that God is a highly personal, self-conscious being with a residential headquarters and at the same time personally present in such a vast universe and personally in contact with such a well-nigh infinite number of beings. That such a phenomenon is a mystery beyond human comprehension should not in the least lessen your faith. Do not allow the magnitude of the infinity, the immensity of the eternity, and the grandeur and glory of the matchless character of God to overawe, stagger, or discourage you. For the Father is not very far from any one of you. He dwells within you. And in him do we all literally move, actually live, and veritably have our being.
Exercise for everyone, a little homework. Spend some time reflecting on that neat parallel they drew in those three things. Magnitude of the infinity, tied to overawe. The immensity of eternity, tied to stagger. And the grandeur and glory of the matchless character tied to discourage. Spend some time reflecting on their choice of words. It's kind of fun there. The one thing I want to bring up, this is in these early papers, when they're doing what they're doing right here, so much really talking about the mother, but not overtly, because they haven't gotten to paper 117 yet. they always bring in the adjuster. Like they did, you know, he dwells within you. They always bring in the adjuster as the way to kind of help you bridge this gap. You know, they draw this stark distinction, you know, that here's you and the Father, and there's darkness all around you, impersonal all around you, you know. And they try to soften that by throwing in the adjuster. They do this in a number of spots when they're really ripe in the mother discussion. And there's a number of on-ramp things in this paragraph that are really interesting. You know, they're trying to very gently move you from the monotheistic deity, magical, you know, God the Father does everything picture. And so they say things in here very gently, like that he is personally present in such a vast universe. But then, you know, you finally finish part one of the book and you start the first paper of part two. And you're in just a little ways and you read, the Universal Father is not personally present in a local universe.
For paper two?
No, that's paper 32 or whatever. Now, part two, paper 32. So this is the way they do this in an evolutional fashion. Okay, and you're going, wait a minute, I found a contradiction in the book. Okay.
Let's what? Check out other religions.
Okay, directly, you know, he's not personally present. They're getting you know, to the very specific facts when you finally get up to paper 32. It's like, okay, now let's talk a little bit more precisely about things, and a little less gently with you. Let's go to the facts more directly. The Universal Father is not personally present out here, period. Okay? But his personality, gravity, is present out here. Yes. Okay, and that personality circus, you know, he's and personally in contact with each of us, like the rest of that sentence says. I mean, it's in that sense, as personality gravity, that he's personally present, but not literally. So you have to put those two things together. And then, of course, another one we've pointed out, look at how it ends. He dwells within you, and they say, use the adjuster. But then they say, and in him we do all literally move, actually live, and veritably have our being. I mean, they even used three adverbs to strengthen it. Literally, actually, veritably. They're saying, well, that's definitive. I mean, and then you go to, of course, the God the Mother paper, paper 117, and it says, from the finite standpoint, we actually live, move, and have our being within the immanence of the Supreme, within the Mother. Going, wait a minute, I thought they said literally, actually, veritably. Yeah, but what's, this says from the finite standpoint. This sentence that we just read, from the infinite standpoint, okay, in him we all literally move, actually live, and veritably have our being. From the infinite standpoint, not from the finite standpoint. Okay. See, both sentences are true, but you have to separate the infinite level from the finite level. Okay. And just notice how gentle that is. This is paper 12. It's not till clear up there that they finally give you the specific facts about that. All right. Let's keep on here. I'm running way over here.
Even though the Paradise Father functions through his divine creators and his creature children, he also enjoys the most intimate inner contact with you, so sublime, so highly personal, that it is even beyond my comprehension. That mysterious communion of the Father fragment with the human soul and with the mortal mind of its actual indwelling, knowing what you do of these gifts of God, you therefore know that the Father is in intimate touch, not only with his divine associates, but also with his evolutionary mortal children of time. The Father indeed abides on paradise, but his divine presence also dwells in the minds of men. Even though the Spirit of a Son be poured out upon all flesh, even though a Son once dwelt with you in the likeness of mortal flesh, even though the seraphim personally guard and guide you, how can any of these divine beings of the second and third centers ever hope to come as near to you or to understand you as fully as the Father, who has given a part of himself to be in you, to be your real and divine, even your eternal self?
See how they ended that? Two paragraphs set apart by a big gap. To kind of, wow, this is getting really hard for me. Can you give me some reassurance that I'm okay? And so they do that. When all is said and done, the Father idea is still the highest human concept of God. You know, in the midst of that, though, you know, they are also trying to strengthen your recognition of the gesture. Do you really understand? I mean, how can any of these divine beings of the second and third centers ever hope to come as near to you or to understand you as fully as the Father? The angels are not the agents of the Father. Well, they're the angels of the third source and center. Okay, and the bestowed Christ Michael is not the agent. He's the agent of the Eternal Son. Okay, look at how they're challenging the history of our thinking here. If you're really interested in the engagement of the Father, don't pray for angels or bestowal sons. There's something much greater than that, something much more intimate than that. And you don't need to pray for it. You already have it. There's absolutely nothing that could be closer to you that loves you more dearly than the Father through the adjuster, not near your mind, within your mind, within your mind. Okay, not just in, within your mind. So they're trying to really drive that home. Yes, we spent a lot of time trying to point out how important it is to recognize the mother, but don't slight the Father in this process. You need an and. Don't let our stressing of the mother make us forget about the Father either. Okay? And the incredibleness of what He's done for us. Okay. To give you this unbelievable amplifier of your I am-ness so that you have a potential to be part of the all like you never had before. Talk about amping up the potential for the brotherhood of man. If there was just someone who would take some delight in cultivating what you actually need to actualize the brotherhood of man, it's not going to grow arithmetically. It's going to grow geometrically because there's this incredible catalytic agent that the Father has put in all of us now, this thought adjuster. Okay? Forget about angels and stuff like that. I mean, if you want to grow the brotherhood of man geometrically, we've got what it takes with the adjuster. Now we're just missing that last component, recognition of the mother and our consecration to the mother, so we can begin to actualize rather than vainly hope for the brotherhood of man. Yeah. All right, let's take a moment here.